good afternoon. Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you today?
I feel good. You know, I'm back from a short vacation, which was nice, and I hope you got a chance to listen to Lily Dale, the trip to Lily Dale last week.
It was a cool program.
Yeah. I got a lot of response. I think a lot of people really resonated with just the whole spiritualist idea, and I just want everyone to know I appreciate your emails, and I love hearing how the shows kind of touch you and your lives in certain ways. So please keep sending them, because it's, you know, in here in my little box, I can't see your face and your reaction to the things I'm saying. So the emails are really nice. And also our Facebook page. I always hope it's going to be a little more of an active hub of responses and messages, but I don't know. I my social media understanding is not strong enough, I guess, to curate an active page. But it's always open for people to respond or ask questions or offer ideas. Because the idea of this conversation is that it's ongoing, that we're always touching in, you know, every Tuesday. But between from Tuesday to Tuesday, things come up or remind us of something. And it's nice to check in. And I grapple with it. And you'll see from today's topic how much I grapple with utilizing social media to try to build community, conversations, a following of people who are kind of like-minded, because the effort that has to go into keeping that going is kind of the antithesis of what I want for people, which is to be extricated from that platform and really having like experiences in front of them. And so I'm always kind of, I grapple with this. You know, should I invest an hour, you know, a day, probably more than an hour, to really make the social media go and the reluctant therapist become something more than just our Tuesday show? Or do I just let it be what it is and, you know, stay true to kind of that therapist in me of, hey, let's focus more on our right now and I'll see you next Tuesday.
It sounds like you're putting a call out for a reluctant therapist intern right now.
But then someone else is devoting a lot of time to that piece. Yeah, so that's another conversation, but that's kind of where I'm at. And for today's conversation, I recognize that the things that are going to come out of my mouth in the first 10 minutes might hit people in a reactive way. Part of me is happy that it might hit you in a reactive way. Another part of me is hoping that you won't shut the gates of your mind down and say, this challenges what I believe, so I don't want to hear it. And I'm hoping that you'll kind of hear me out a little bit so we can get to the meat of the conversation. But to kind of the post-introduction of the show today was, what do children need to thrive in adulthood? Which is not the way we often talk about childhood. Usually we talk about childhood as this magical time period from 0 to 16 or 18 or 25, however you define entering into adulthood. Neurologically, it's actually 25, but socially we like to say it's 18. But we talk about childhood as a sacred period of time where we want to keep children kind of bubbled in the beauty of life, you know, believing in magic and fairies and the best of all human beings, and everyone gets invited to your birthday party and no one ever gets left out, and, you know, no one ever gets their feelings hurt. And like, we strive for that. But the reality is, at what point then do we take off the veil of childhood and say, oh, just kidding. Really, when you enter into adulthood, people don't, you know, respect your boundaries, and it's going to be tough, and you're going to have your feelings hurt, and you're probably going to be sad as often as you're happy. And if you can be happy even a little bit more than you're sad, that's a huge win. But let's be prepared for the long period of times where you actually feel kind of crappy, and be able to work with that. Like, at what age do we do that? And people ask me that all the time. Like, at what age can I strip my children of their childhood and say, and now here are the raw facts? And there isn't an age. There isn't. Because things happen. Some children experience trauma at a young age that strips the veil and parents can't do anything about it. Some people enter into midlife with the veil of childhood still around them and happily believe that the world exists for them. So there is no set time. But what motivated today's show and why I feel like we need to have the conversation is kind of threefold. One, we're back to school and we're thinking about the institution of our public education system and what it is we hope for our children and what it is we can expect from schools. I got a picture from the first day of preschool from my granddaughter, Georgia, today, and I looked at her little face, and the grandma in me just wanted to wrap her in bubble wrap and keep everything scary and not conducive to a joyful childhood away from her. And I understand that instinct because it lives in all of us. And I think about my, you know, younger daughter going back for her final quarter of her college education, or the last, like, in our family, mandated education that she'll have. And now kind of setting her off into the world. And in my head, I'm running through this list. You know, did I warn her about this? Did I tell her about this? Have we stripped all of the veils of childhood from her so she knows that life is tough and disappointing and she may not get what she wants? And so those things are going on. And then I don't know about you, but I tuned into the hearings today for Brett Kavanaugh. They just were on the TV. In all honesty, it was my daughter Kelly who called and reminded me, Mom, you need to watch this. Because I feel this responsibility as a citizen to participate in all the ways I can. And for some reason, watching makes me feel like I'm participating. But it reminded me that we need to help our children prepare for adulthood in their childhood years so that when they find themselves sitting in committee, whatever that committee is, a PTA, a church committee, a governmental body of some sort, that they have the skills to engage with each other in productive and honest and meaningful ways. And I don't feel like that model is there for them. And the thing that stood out for me, and you can let me know if you agreed, but the thing that stood out with me for me was that many of the senators were bringing up times of the past when things went well, when we used civil discourse, when people used precedence, when we as a government or a country or a nation, you know, stood up for a sense of values. And they named people from 100 years ago or 200 years ago who stood for these. And what it said to me was, where are the people right now who we can turn to and look towards and say, I can hold you up to the standard of adulthood that I would like my children to model themselves after? Where are they? Where do they exist? And if we don't have that, then it falls on us as adults, as parents, as grandparents, to live our lives in such a way that we model that. And so that brings me to my last point, which sets up today's show, which is about bullying. And the news over the last year seems to have been almost monthly some case of bullying that has led a young child to take their own life, which is unprecedented. We've always had bullying, and we've had children that have been tormented and come through school traumatized. But this level of suicide as a response by these children to bullying has raised the awareness of bullying or the concern or fear about bullying to a very high level, which is important. My concern is that our response to bullying is ineffective. We can't just keep throwing together preventative programs, institutionalized programs, and throw them into the schools and expect that to solve the problem, because they don't. Almost every single preventative program we've thrown into schools to keep children safe have been a failure. DARE is the perfect example. The use of drug and alcohol through children who've been through the DARE program actually went up year after year after year. DARE keeps reinventing itself to also include say no to drugs and alcohol, and now to, you know, no anti-bullying and be kind to each other, but it still does not statistically have the results that we need. conversely, we've actually seen the incidence of bullying and suicide in adolescents go up through the years that we've been throwing these programs into schools. And one of, there's many reasons why the programs fail, but the most obvious reason is that we're going after symptoms and not after core issues that are driving the symptomatic behavior. Not that bullying is acceptable, but if you understand what drives bullying, you have a better chance of redirecting bullying behavior than just stamping it out. Because if you've been a parent, you know one thing about kids and discipline, that if you go after them and shame them or are harsh with them and try to just extinguish behaviors you don't like, it generally doesn't extinguish the behavior. It just makes the kids way sneakier and better at getting away with the behaviors so they don't get caught. So there's two types of bullying that we see in children, peer bullying. One is reactive bullying and one is proactive bullying. Proactive bullying is a style of aggression where one child targets and bullies another child to gain status for themselves. They think it makes them cool. Their friends, you know, give them more attention. They somehow gain social status in their school and their peer group because they're picking on a younger, weaker child. And the reason that proactive bullying exists is because it works. And it gives children over a period of time actually more social status. And the frightening part about proactive bullying is that it is a learned behavior. That when they look at the origins of proactive bullying, most children have learned that behavior from the adults that they spend time with. Or if you look at our political activities, proactive bullying is a result of, right, bullying other people to make yourself look strong. The other part about proactive bullying that makes it difficult to address is that people who are aggressive with their peers or with others generally are very frightened of losing power and control. And when people are frightened of losing power and control, they become more aggressive in response. And so you may discipline them. They may get kicked out of school, which only goes to make them more popular, right? It's the things that we're doing as an institution in response to bullying that's actually making bullying more prevalent. When children go and tattle on bullying in their school, it makes the child even more of a target. And when someone gets called out for bullying, it makes them more of a folklore hero in that peer group. And so unintentionally, these programs are actually making bullying even more pervasive in schools. The second bullying type is reactive bullying. And reactive bullying is a response to being frustrated. When someone feels thwarted from getting what they want out of life or in the moment, they respond with aggression, out of frustration, kind of impulsive, being demeaning to someone else. Think of trade negotiations. When a country feels like they're not getting what they deserve, they react with aggression. It's, again, a learned behavior. So I don't want to diminish how horrific the response to being bullied is in young people, in anyone, this sense of being traumatized and isolated and left out. But the way we approach bullying has got to change if we want to see diminished suicidal ideation or suicide attempts, if we want to see a campus, a college campus or an elementary school campus where students feel safe and connected and able to thrive. They're not going to get along with everyone on the campus. The reality is you're not going to have any experience where everyone is best friends. But if we want to address those things, and I think that's our common goal as parents, as administrators, as educators, as grandparents, as government officials, our common goal is to create safe spaces for our children to go and learn and thrive, then we need to change the way we address the issues that our kids are facing. We have to stop throwing programs at problems, at symptoms, and start addressing fundamentally what kids need to thrive. Because one of the arguments is that we don't know how difficult it is for children today, that they are dealing with things that no other generation has ever dealt with. And that is true. But every generation of children have had things that they've had to deal with. And what children need to thrive hasn't changed, no matter what the political culture is or the cultural culture is, whether it's living through the Depression or a world war or screens. Every childhood has the same needs, and that is learning to thrive, get along, build resilience, develop a strong social network, and find a way to make a world for themselves in a world that is not inherently inviting. So I've invited a guest in today, Brianne Burkhart.
Hi.
Hi, Bri. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for letting me set the stage, because I didn't want to just throw the idea of the bullying prevention programs don't work, therefore let's throw everything out and then walk away from it, because that's not a good enough answer. I wanted to poke the bear a little bit that we should rethink things like bullying prevention programs, which cost a lot of money, and the schools bring them in, and then they feel like we've done our part, and now we can walk away from it. Why don't we take all that money and start bringing actual proactive activities in that build community and build resilience and build self-esteem, so that children find a place on campus for themselves, that they find a way to grow and recognize that things are not always going to be fair and they're not always going to be safe. And so I invited you in because I want you to talk about, as a mom of two young sons, what are some of the things you're doing proactively to help your children grow into adulthood while still having a childhood. And we're going to open the phone lines up and kind of discuss all of these issues, a bit about how do schools, what are schools' responsibilities in helping children grow? What are our parental responsibilities in preparing our children for adulthood? And what things are positive steps we can take? So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and you are invited to be part of the conversation at 805-781-3875. We'll be back to open up the phone lines, take your calls, and explore the topic.
Suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair, it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. My mask, my sails were set wing to wing. I had a jukebox graduate for.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Brianne Burkhart is my guest today, and I'm not sure what we're talking about, but I know that our theme is how do we prepare our children for adulthood? And so talk about that. How old are your boys, and what is your conscious plan for getting them ready to be grown-ups?
So I have a 4- and a 6-year-old boy, and they, boys, and they are wild and spirited and all those wonderful things you'd want them to be. But the big concern, and I'll let you know when they get to adulthood how my plan worked.
always the hard part, because there isn't a game.
Guidebook.
No,
there's no guidebook. Book. And so I think for me, what I saw with my kids, and then the things that have caused the most concern for me as far as parenting them to this point, is I wasn't feeling drawn and connected to the institutionalized public schooling that I had them in. And so I found alternative options. Thank goodness there were some in this community. So I now pulled them out of public school, and I have them in a hybrid homeschool program that is classical education. And it's so rich in education. And I was mentioning to you before we even started that the theme this year is wonder. And it's a quote from Socrates. And it says, wonder is the beginning of wisdom. And my biggest thing that I want to see from these kids is integrity. is self-worth, is the understanding of you are an individual, but a part of a greater whole. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's through church or education or family, I want to be able to provide them opportunities to get outside of themselves, to serve, to experience nature and things that make them feel small, but big at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, those are the keys to helping them understand that their choices have consequences and their words have effects and their actions can create change.
What about being bullied though and picked on?
Yeah, so bullied. So this is the interesting thing, because mm-hmm. that's my fear, as well as them being at the hands of a bully, is potentially they could be a bully. Okay. You know, and I think you see how different animal groups or social groups interact, and it's a pecking order, and it's establishing dominance, and it's understanding your place. And first years in school, that's kind of what is started. And Jeremiah, my oldest, he's 6. He's like, oh, there's bullies at school. And I'm like, but what are bullies? And we talk about, what are the reasons you think this person is acting this way? Kind of getting under this under the actions and the symptoms and understanding what the causes might be. And when you have an understanding, a greater understanding of why you're acting a certain way or someone else is acting a certain way towards you, you can have compassion, you can have empathy, and you can have better solutions to the problem. So even if the boys are bullying each other in their relationship, why are you acting that way? What are you really feeling? How do you want to communicate it? We've talked a lot, an exhausting amount, about how to communicate your feelings, how to communicate what's frustrating you, and how to have coping skills. This is the big thing that I think we're missing as far as bullying goes, is that the symptom is the way that they're coping with the different stresses they're encountering in life and in this environment. So how do we give them proper coping skills to express their feelings, express how they're feeling challenged or frightened or whatever?
Well, and I think it's interesting being on the other side of it, you know, now being a nana and mm-hmm. not an active mom, that I look back over, you know, the goals my husband and I set for our girls. And I'm always amazed that we thought about setting goals, because no one told us to. Mm. And it wasn't until I started doing this work professionally that I realized how important it was for parents to actually have a mission statement as a family, and to have expectations and have some ideas of who you'd like your children to be when they leave your home. Because without that, you are kind of at the mercy of whatever the culture tells you mm-hmm. your kids should be doing. Mm-hmm. And so that's how you all of a sudden find yourself with your children overcommitted in activities and feeling overwhelmed and going down 6 different paths and trying to get along with everyone. And it's interesting that by taking charge of your role as a parent, and that it is a job, and that you do have a duty to raise your children and to prepare them for life, that it changes the way I think you go about interacting with your children. Mm-hmm. That you don't just hand them over to institutions and
hope
trust
they do a good job.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big thing for us is that before we go into any social environment, whether it's school, whether it's going to a new activity with different people that they don't know, we like to have a conversation. So what do you think the boundaries are at this place that we go to? What do you think my expectations of you are? What are your expectations of yourself? What do you hope will happen? How are you going to happen? You know, deal with it if it doesn't happen the way you want it to. And a lot of it is role playing. A lot of it is discussing all those things. And to me, too, although it's my responsibility and my husband's responsibility to prepare them, I also find it really important not to see it as a reflection of my parenting, how they cope, and to observe and address the different ways that their personalities are going to handle these different situations. Because if I make it too much about me and whether I'm doing a good enough job, I get so caught up in my own head that I can't see what they're trying to tell me.
Right. That you just want them to project
perfection.
Yes. Please be perfect. So then we won't go into the bullying that happens to parents.
Yeah.
Towards other parents.
Totally.
You know, if we're going to talk about bullying, we have to understand where it comes from. And you see it in how countries treat other countries, how politicians treat other politicians, and how employees are treated by their employers. You know, that people are bullied at the workplace, and then they take that home and unintentionally recreate that environment in their home with their kids. Spouses can get into bullying situations with each other. And so it is so important to be able to step back and recognize the effect that your actions have, and to, again, not take bullies, throw them into a bucket and say they're all bad, horrible people. I just don't want my children to be that, because that's not going to respect, because we all have the capacity to bully inside of us. And I think that's the most important, honest thing we could do, is recognize that given the right circumstances, we all have a bully in us. Mm-hmm. And how do we learn to deal with that and then model that for our children? This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. My guest is Brianne Burkhart. And Garland, you're joining us on the air. What's on your mind?
How are you doing?
We're good.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I wanted to say a couple quick things.
Okay.
I think our schools should teach our kids, first of all, how to balance a checkbook and really look at planning for retirement, because none of them really think that they're going to really get old, but it happens.
That's a good point. And the next one?
But the next one is when it comes to bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And the key to that is that recognizing that the bully is insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And since the person is really insecure, really focus on what they are really saying and then decipher from that what it's really all about.
Thank you, Garland. Okay. So, again, this is a tough topic, because if you've ever been the subject of bullying, it's merciless. The children who are bullied intensely, it'd be very difficult to step back and say, well, this clearly is just an insecure person. So how do you think we dance between those two things? One, how do we get into the heart of someone who feels like bullying is their only way of interacting with others? And two, how do we help someone who's being bullied to respond?
So first, to deal with the person that's receiving the bullying, I think we have to understand how to establish self-worth and understand that their worthiness doesn't come from what someone else is saying about you. And that's so difficult, because the schools only have your kids for a certain amount of time. So what are they being exposed to and taught at home? And how is their worthiness going to be established in that sense? Are they simple things like chores, simple things like earning something, establishes self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth. If you have an, and then also for us as parents, we like to get our kids outside of our bubble of beautiful Aurora Grande and go travel other places, see how other people live. Understand that we are in this, we are a tiny speck in this ginormous world, and seeing outside of this bubble of whatever's happening to you at this moment doesn't mean that this is how your life is going to continue forever.
And I think that's why it becomes so toxic on a school campus, because
yes,
for kids,
that's
they're
everything.
Dropped off every day, right? And the whole world is that. And so when I would work with parents whose children were being bullied or not doing well with a teacher or struggling in elementary school, much to their surprise, I would often say, how far are you willing to go to help your child thrive? Are you willing to change schools? Are you willing to take them out of school and go travel? Are you willing to, you know, change your work hours so that you can go to the school? You know, what are you willing to do? And for a lot of parents, that was an acceptable answer. They wanted the schools to change what they were doing to make their child's life better. And what you're saying, I think a lot of times, and I think just in our lives as adults, when we get into toxic situations, removing ourselves from the little world that we're in can help give us perspective. But when we feel trapped, you know, if someone needs that job in order to pay their bills, and that child, you know, his parents are both working full time and they don't want to, a lot of children don't tell their parents they're being bullied because they don't want their parents to feel stressed or uncomfortable. And so as parents, how do we create an environment at home so our children don't feel like they have to take care of us, so that they can come home and say, hey, here's what I'm struggling with at school. And then you can brainstorm together so they feel like they have allies outside of school.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important, too, to allow your kids to, it starts with the simple things. Are you listening to them when it comes to everyday occurrences? Mom, I really want to show you this thing I built, that you're like in the middle of doing dishes and you don't want to take that time to do something. Are you present with them? If you're present with them for the small things, you're going to be present with them for the big things, and they're going to feel safe enough to come to you for those big things. And then as far as the bullies go, like, how do we address what symptom they're expressing with their
right, what is
skills?
Driving
like
this?
What's driving it?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's interesting because I think anytime, you know, you're talking about why the anti-bullying programs aren't working, I wonder what would happen if schools took these groups of kids and got them out in nature and got them out camping, team building, working together. I work with youth in the church that I'm in, and every single girl that I work with is a different personality, comes from a different background, different everything, wouldn't normally choose to hang out with one another.
Right.
But when you get them out in nature or you get them working on something together, not only do they feel good about themselves, but they feel good about helping each other. It takes about 24 hours and then the bonds start to happen. And it's like that understanding that you don't have to particularly love this other person or like who they are all the time, but can you work together? Can you get outside of yourself and find ways to connect and to bond? And we're teaching kids that you should be happy all the time, and you never should have to suffer, and you never should have to deal with anyone you don't like. And that's not real. That's not real life.
Well, and that's why I think I offered up this idea of, instead of spending a lot of money on these programs that come in and promise to change a school, DARE included, bullying prevention programs, anything that is being sold, you know, this is a program that's making money for other people, well-intentioned and probably has some good research behind it, but you have to go deeper and see what is the long-term impact on my campus. And wouldn't it be better if we took that money and brought in programs that are long-lasting? I mean, it's no secret that I love Destination Imagination because it's a creative program. It gets kids an opportunity to think outside the box and build projects and not have adults telling them how to think. But it also, the teams that do best are made up of students who wouldn't necessarily, as you said, spend time together. Mm-hmm. Because in order to succeed at this problem, you need someone who's a good engineer and someone who's a good actor and someone who's very creative. And these children learn to appreciate each other. And I think that is a great recipe for building more cohesive, safe haven experiences on campus, because then you also have children who've spent time together, and you might have an athlete who was on, you know, a team with a student who's kind of shy or awkward, and they've built a relationship. And if that child is getting picked on, that athlete is much more
100%
apt to come over and defend someone that they've had a relationship with. And so to me, it's not, it may feel like it's simplifying the issue, but it's healthier steps towards building a community where more people feel safe. We're never going to make 100% of the people safe, but we can build a community of togetherness. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. My guest today is Breanne Burkhart, and we're talking about what do children need to thrive in adulthood? We understand all of the opportunities for childhood, but what are those skills that children need to learn as they work their way into the adult world? And we're going to come back, take your calls, and talk about some actual agenda items for your parenting. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
See the world different than me. Sometimes I can touch upon the wonders that you see. And pictures you've designed. Oh, yes, sweet darling. So glad you are a child of mine. Child of mine. Child of mine. Oh, yes, sweet darling.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. What are your thoughts about preparing your child for adulthood? Do you have a family plan or a mission statement or some goals that you've set out to achieve with your child? What is it that they need to learn as they move into adulthood? Because I think, and Garland made a great point, I think when we start off on this journey raising our children, that it never occurs to us that they're actually going to leave home, and that they're going to grow, and that we're going to be facing retirement, and that we really should be thinking about these things when our children are young. But, you know, you really only have 16 active years with your children before they start to really move towards their peer groups and, you know, away from you as their primary contact. And then maybe another 6 to 8 years, you know, 25 is when we say developmentally that children are fully formed adults. So you have, you know, more passive years that you can influence your child's life, but it's really those 16 years that you have to influence the adults that they become. And so, all right, Bree, I'm going to throw out some of the things on our family mission statement, and I'd love you to add to or expand on it. The very first thing that I have, what my children need, and I think all children need to thrive in adulthood, is an ability to communicate and engage with others. And I hate to always go back and bash on the social media because I brought it up at the beginning of the show, but my concern about screens, and right now the most recent study showed that preschoolers are spending an average of 4 hours a day in front of a screen. 4 hours. And statistically, it takes less than 2 hours a week. God, that seems so low because now people are on it so much, to see rises in anxiety and depression. So 4 hours average daily. In that time, that's allowing children to withdraw from tough relationships, to avoid uncomfortable interactions. You know, we've built a whole diagnosis around social anxiety, which has given children and adults an excuse to not have to engage in the community. And that, to me, is a crisis. Because if we can't communicate and engage with others, if we don't know how to read social cues, if we don't know how to start a conversation, then we have nowhere to go.
Yes.
We can't build on anything. I think our communication skills are key. And as adults, because our children are watching us every day, as adults, if we're uncomfortable communicating, if we're using our phone to text and avoid conversations, I laugh so hard because last night my husband sent me a text actually from the front yard to come out and help wash the truck. And I said, we have become those people. Why are you doing this? This is everything that but it's so easy to, the point is, it's so easy to slip into it. Mm-hmm. It's easy to slip into not having to actively communicate and engage with others. And so those things that you find most challenging are probably the place you need to spend the most time. Number two, an ability to find joy, be in awe of something, and have a sense of respect for the world outside of yourself. And you had mentioned that earlier, that sense of feeling small in the face of something amazing, beautiful, awe-inspiring, like nature or a belief in a spiritual being or something. Because if we want to help children build resilience towards suicidal ideation or towards being bullied or towards disappointment, they have to feel like they are a part of something bigger than the microcosm of their day-to-day.
Yeah, the two points that you have kind of sum up one of the main points that my husband and Chris and I have, which is getting outside of their comfort zone and mm-hmm. being okay doing something that scares you. And so Chris would probably liken that more to like, okay, jump off that cliff. You're going to be okay. You can cliff jump right
now. Which is what dads do.
Right, that's a dad thing. Much more physical, right?
Yes.
And to me, I'm much more emotionally connected and about communication. Same thing that you're saying. Get outside of your comfort zone. Do that thing that scares you. And then on the other side of that, it's so much more beautiful. It's so much more amazing. And you're missing out on it if you never push yourself past that point.
But say hi to someone because if you say hi to 10 kids, one of them may end up being your best friend.
Yes. And my oldest son, he's notorious for saying what's on his mind all the time. And I remember we were walking through the grocery store and he was like, wow, look at that old man. He's so old. And he said it so loud that the old man obviously heard him. And although it was a very truthful statement, I got on his level and I said, look, did you ever meet that man? He might be a lot more than just old. What's his name? We're going to go introduce ourselves, you know? And I think the big key to all of this issue is humanizing each other. Mm-hmm. We create this barrier, whether it's a phone, whether it's our own bubble, whatever it is, our own thoughts, our own fears, this barrier that keeps us from connecting in a real honest way and understanding that we're all human and we are all connected. Whether we can relate on one thing or another, there's going to be a commonality between all of us.
Right.
And so teaching my son, like, hey, this man is human and what you said might have hurt his feelings. So how do we connect with him and understand who he is in other ways besides what you're just seeing on the outside?
Yeah. And it's interesting because I'm listening to you talk and the intentionality of the parenting. It makes me a little bit tired.
It's constant.
It is constant. And I think that that's, in preparing for the show today, you and I were sending each other articles, and one of the ones I sent you was on distracted parenting. And the thesis of the author was that we spend so much time obsessing on the amount of time our children are on screens, we should be paying attention to how much time parents are on their screens.
Totally.
Because that's having a bigger impact.
Modeling.
Yes, you're modeling this behavior and a way of escaping from the day-to-day, but it's also breaking, it's interesting. We spend more time actually with our children today actively than mothers did in the 60s.
Than ever before.
But we're less emotionally attached to our children. We're physically in their space, but we're not emotionally attuned to them because we're constantly drifting out of our attention with them. Mm. And it actually has a psychological term called continuous partial attention. That we think we're really engaged in doing everything, but we're not 100% involved in anything in our lives, which causes us as adults to feel anxious, to feel depressed, to feel overwhelmed, to feel like we're never finishing our job, to feel like we're never, relaxed fully when we're relaxing. And so the beauty of our phones and social media is that we have constant access, but the detriment is that we have constant access. And so as parents, the research on this kind of this unspoken tie between children and their parents. It's the eye contact. It's that attention that we're spending, looking at them, listening to their words. And so if you're only partially there all the time, scanning on your Instagram and answering questions, that connection is broken, and it gives children a sense of feeling anxious and depressed, and they start to act out to get your attention. Mm-hmm. Because good behavior, if you're a distracted parent, never gets recognized. If the kids are quiet, then I can just look through my phone, mm-hmm. or I can work, because a lot of people are trying to work from home. And so good behavior starts to not pay off for children, so they start being negative in their behavior. And they're going to keep ramping up that negative behavior until they get your attention. And here it goes back to what I talk about. We as a society always are addressing symptoms and not root causes. So here's the slippery slope that terrifies me. A child whose parent is distracted, trying to do the best they can, but they are always kind of half there with their child and answering off the cuff. And so the child starts acting out, and they're not getting attention. And so they poke the cat, still no attention. They poke their sibling, still no attention. They break a glass, still no attention. They throw something in anger. And then the parent turns around and said, "You're out of control. You must have a problem. You must be oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder or ADHD. Let's get some medicine. You need to calm down." And so without seeing all the steps that got that child to that place, this child now has been pathologized in our society for just trying to be recognized.
You know what the scariest thing is, too, is it's scary to be present.
Yes, it is.
And so we, out of fearfulness of our own selves, it's scary to be present in your own life. If you're unhappy with how things are going with your husband, or how things are going with work, or how things are going with your lot in life, it's easy to escape.
It is.
And so we are teaching our kids that scary things we run away from, we don't face. And I'm seeing it all the time. And it's a human response to want to retreat from something that causes you discomfort. But when you are able to work through, I notice with myself, if I'm getting overwhelmed, if I'm getting anxious, if I'm getting stressed out and I'm checking out too much, let's get out of the house. Let's go somewhere. Let's go up north. Let's go to the beach. Let's just spend a day together as a family. It might be really hard for that first hour. And then it just, it's like you can take a deep breath and you can see each other again. You can get back into the groove of that family unit and connecting with each other and being vulnerable. Being vulnerable is what I'm talking about too, is being present. And that's not comfortable either.
Because I think the vulnerability in letting your children know, hey, mom has a limit. I need 15 minutes.
Yes.
That we also have to build in, if we're not going to be distracted and we are going to be present with our children when we're present, we also need to feel okay saying, "And now I need 15 minutes. So here's a project you can do, or go outside and find something to do because I need 15
yes.
minutes." And we have to be able to do that. And it's the same with our work, and it's the same with our spouses and our partnerships and our friendships. It's, I have this time, and you need to make that time, but then you also have to be okay with not being on call. Because if we're always in this period of hyperdrive, it causes anxiety because there's never a reset.
or being hyper aware of what your kids' needs are. There's a certain level of distractedness that happens when you're so fixated on what your kids are doing, or what their actions are, instead of letting them be themselves or having outside time and getting a little bit of freedom and allowing them that, or allowing them to, like with my sons, they love each other, but they fight hard. And so it's that fine balance between, you guys need to figure that out. Don't come and ask me how to solve that. You guys know how to communicate what you want from each other. So stepping in, but it all comes back to being present and in tune with what your kids needs and in tune with what you need.
Finding, and you said also not taking it personally.
Yeah, yeah.
If the kids don't get along, it's not about you in that moment. It's about their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to my list of things that kids need. Okay. Problem-solving skills, so it goes back to what you're saying. They have to know the skills of how to get into conflict and out of conflict. And one of the best ways for kids to learn that skill is through play, unstructured play, a pickup soccer game where there's no referee, because then they have to figure out how to call fouls or throw the ball in on their own, or games of tag or hide-and-go-seek where there's no referee and there's no mom. And that if children spend 10 years, 16 years in periods of unstructured play, they have to have conflict, work it out, and move on. They might tussle. They, you know, my brother and I definitely fought to the death for most of our childhood, but it gave us a lot of skills moving into adulthood. And so there's that ability to be separate from our parents. Parents are there, we're separate, and we're learning to problem solve on our own is critical. And the fifth skill, or the fifth thing that children need to thrive in adulthood, is a strong social network. And it's really important to have people that you can count on. That we have this idea that we're supposed to have 100 friends, but really people can only manage, I think, 15 intimate relationships total.
That's a lot to me.
It is a lot.
but
we can't maintain hundreds. And I noticed that, and I think I've said this before, that as my family has grown, I have a son-in-law and my granddaughter, that I'm looking at my interrelationships, but I have to let somebody go.
Right.
Because I have family members. But to really model for our children that intimacy in our social network, because when you are bullied, when you are heartbroken, when you are disappointed, you need to have a place to retreat to where there are people who will circle the wagons. And I think we underestimate the value and importance of that social network, and that we let go of those relationships because for some reason we think there's always another one. And that, as you've mentioned, sticking in a relationship that's challenging. Anytime two people are together, there's going to be conflict. And sticking with that relationship and growing more intimacy and more trust is a lot harder than bailing mm-hmm. and starting new ones. Mm-hmm. But if we are continuously starting new relationships, you have no safe space.
And knowing and teaching your kids what toxic relationships look like. So there is that balance, once again, where you're nurturing those good relationships that might be challenging, that might force you to grow. But then you're also helping them recognize this is what you deserve in a relationship. This is where your worth is at. And this is how you hold boundaries. And this is how you keep people in the place that makes sense for what's healthy for you.
Or basically saying that friendship sucks.
Yeah, that too. That's not a nice person.
I like a long conversation, but sometimes you have to say that is not a friend.
Yes.
That is not how a friend behaves. And to be able to recognize that.
Which I'm seeing with so many people, and being around young girls, the group I work with is 12 to 18, even the boys that they choose to date, or the boys that they choose to surround themselves with, or the friends that they choose. It's who is a true friend to you that cares and will support you and work through things with you.
And that we have to do another show on that.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a whole nother skill set.
Yes.
It's a whole other show, but I'm dying to know what you think, because part of me also believes that we put way too much
emphasis
on friendships being that supportive, that we don't put enough emphasis on that blood relations as being the people that are really going to circle the wagons. That I think we've taught young women that their friendships are going to be eternal.
They're sisters.
Yes. Yeah. That's another show.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is Brianne Burkhart. I've known her since she was 9 months old. Her mom was my first friend I made when we moved here 30 plus years ago. And so watching you grow has been a pleasure. And in watching you kind of dive into raising your sons and knowing, I know that you have a really intentional way of wanting them to be raised. And even when people push back on you or are not on board with you, that you've really committed yourself to your parenting style. So having said that, let's talk about self-esteem, which is kind of the overriding goal, I think, or skill children need to thrive in adulthood. Because there's been a lot of discussion over the last 50 years about what really is self-esteem and what is not self-esteem. And that we've, instead of helping children earn a sense of well-being and confidence by their actions, by developing skills or having heartache or failing at things and then gaining mastery of things. Those are real self-esteem builders. We've created a culture where everyone gets a prize. And it's so funny that it still continues because everyone gets that. Oh, we shouldn't be giving prizes to every child for showing up. We shouldn't be telling every child that they're magic and perfect. Even though we say that, we're still parenting in that way where we believe that if we never let our child feel sad, they'll have high self-esteem and they'll be protected from being hurt.
I think also we need to think about the first thing that comes to mind for me is, where do I get my self-esteem from? Good. What is it that
goes back to the parent
model? It goes back. It really does, because if you haven't done the work for yourself to figure out, am I putting my worth? What am I putting my worth in, and what am I modeling is important to me and makes me feel good? Is what I'm posting really valuable to me? How many people like it or whatever? Because my generation is the generation that grew up with the internet, grew up with social media starting. So we are modeling how you interact with the world and what's important to you. So how are you going to be able to show your kids what's going to bring them true, lasting self-esteem versus temporary satisfaction?
A like versus an internal sense of well-being.
And being okay no matter what other people think about. Do you know who you are well enough that it's not going to matter what this person says or that person says? And how do you find contentment and fulfillment? And you're not happy all the time. You don't have to be happy all the time to be fulfilled and content with who you are.
Well, I think the thing that I struggled with most, and I think I still do, is I'm more protective of one of my daughters than the other one.
You see their strengths and you see what they need.
And I want...
My mom's the same way.
Yeah, and I want the world to see my daughter in the way that I see her. And I found myself stepping in more and instead of stepping back and allowing her own resilience and strength and self to go out there, take her hits, which she's going to take, and then grow and learn from that and be okay with that. And I think that's a struggle for a lot of parents, is that watching your child suffer is the greatest pain.
And we're subconsciously telling them that they can't get through it by being the ones that
rescue.
And I'm the same way. I watch my 6-year-old. He really struggles when it comes, he really cares what people think. He really cares about how he enters a room. And if people are looking at him, it really makes him feel uncomfortable. And so instead of me being like, okay, come close to me, I'll help you, we'll go and say hi to these people, I'll maybe show that a little bit. And then, okay, take a step back, it's your turn. And it's really painful, but it starts there and it continues for the rest of their lives. And I think too, I think about my mom and how she parents both of us differently. And that's going to naturally happen based on what each child needs. But she's learned over the years that the other child is just as capable of what the other child is capable of. And by letting them experience life in that way, I'm supporting them and becoming who they're supposed to be. I'm not keeping them from it. I'm not sheltering them from it. I'm allowing it to flow into who they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and so when it goes back to kind of to full circle this in a way, I think about, our goals as parents and as individuals, that we have an idealized version of what we'd like the world to be, and we can't lose sight of that. That we should always be striving for a place of equality and accepting and allowing people to be who they are in all their beautiful ways, and always moving towards that. I think that is our highest intention as human beings. But then to also be able to step back and with some realistic eyes say, but here's where we are today. Here's what goes on in our culture today, or here's what goes on in this community today, and how can I prepare you to take your hits and still move forward, still have faith in the universe, but be prepared for huge disappointment. So if you had one thing that you've learned that you'd want to share with another parent about something you've learned, what would that be?
I think the one thing that I'd want to, the ultimate thing for me that makes sense for my family, and it doesn't mean that that's what's going to make sense for yours, is that getting outside and doing something as a family and getting outside into nature. And I know it sounds so cheesy.
I know.
But truly being able to like be outside of yourself in a place that makes you feel small, but makes you understand that everything's connected is one of the most bonding experiences and perspective giving experiences that you can provide your kids. Giving their kids perspective is going to give them an ability to address anything that they have and they face in life.
And I also think for me, one of the things that has been really important is for my children to see that all relationships have their struggles, that, you know, that their dad and I love each other and support each other and we are a family, but we also have conflict and arguments and periods of time where we don't even want to be in the same room together. But when push comes to shove, this is where our loyalty and family lies, and that this is the safe place. And my daughter would come home and want to complain about what was happening or some horrible people or, you know, being bullied in high school. And my first response was always to want to, you know, you need to be able to be strong and resilient and, you know, look for good in them. And she would always remind me, but you said I could come home and in this space I could say whatever I wanted. And then when I go out there in the world, I have to. And so I love that reminder that
we don't have to fix it. We just need to be the safe place.
The safe place. If we're talking about creating a safe haven, it starts at home. Mm. And then that gets modeled to our schools. And maybe that helps address our bullying issue.
Mm-hmm.
Brianne, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and we can continue this conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can also podcast our show by visiting NPR One or Apple Podcasts. Look for a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Hit subscribe, and the shows will be uploaded to your device, and you can listen at any time. Please pass the show on to friends and family. Have discussions around it. If you'd like to send me an email, you can find me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows that Tyler gets uploaded very quickly at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. I look forward to continuing this conversation. I look forward to sharing another Tuesday afternoon with you next Tuesday at 2. Thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.
She takes me away to that special place, and if I stay too long, I'd probably break down.